Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Gigabit Nation Broadband Talk Radio. I'm your host, Craig Fettles, and I want to welcome everyone in the audience today. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Today's program, as all our programs are for the month of August, is sponsored by Hiawatha Broadband Communications, an FTP provider committed to connecting rural communities and economies to the world. And you can check out Hiawatha Broadband at www.hbci.com. So we're here to help give you good information on how to get more, better broadband to everywhere it needs to be. And today we're going to talk about a very critical element of bringing broadband to communities, which is public-private partnerships. Just one little housekeeping item here. We aren't going to be taking call-ins, but the live chat room is open and ready to go. And so let's work it. So our guest today is Gary Evans, who's the CEO of Hiawatha Broadband, and he was one of my early invites back when I was like dreaming up this whole Gigabit Nation radio show. And because we have talked a number of occasions for different articles and stuff that I've written, and he's got a very good perspective on, you know, the role of the private sector and the public sector and how to work together to get broadband in places where it needs to be. But now, before we get there, Gary, thank you very much for being on the show today.
My pleasure, Craig.
And it's also been very interesting because we were supposed to be on yesterday, but Gary got that call that many of us dream of, which is a call to hang out with the President of the United States. And I am just so jazzed about that that I want to get into that a little bit, because the reason for the invite was to talk about broadband, you know, Gary's perspective on broadband and how it affects local economies. So Gary, just go into it. You know, you're winging it back from Vermont, and all of a sudden you get the call. And what was the nature of yesterday's event?
The president has begun a 3-day bus tour of Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois, Craig. And yesterday was his first stop in Cannon Falls, Minnesota, a community about 50 miles north west of Winona. My son happens to be a bank president there. And it was a town forum in an outdoor setting. So we sat in a beautiful park by the Cannon River and discussed all sorts of issues important to the country.
Good deal. And then you specifically had a question regarding broadband, if I remember the transcript correctly.
I did. The president, after making some opening remarks, and you probably heard that he took several shots at Congress for things he didn't like, but after that said he was opening it to questions, and they would be done in girl-boy fashion to satisfy his wife and daughters. So after taking the first female question, he pointed at me. I had a front row seat, and said, "Sir, what's on your mind?" And so I raised the importance of broadband in a setting where I thought the comments probably would at least be heard and hopefully listened to.
Great. So now, what exactly did you bring up, and what was the president's response?
I told him first that I thought that it is the small companies today who are really the innovators and the job creators. And I asked specifically that the job creators not be penalized. As we see the mega mergers occur, Century buying Quest as an example, or the other mergers that we've read about, job forces tend to contract as opposed to expand. I pointed out to him that our workforce, which just over a year and a half ago numbered 60, today went over the 100 mark as we continue to grow our business. That resonated with him. He seemed very pleased by that. It also got a nice round of applause. And then we talked about the incredible importance of broadband to rural America. It's a subject near and dear to my heart for lots of reasons. First of all, because I live in rural America. But I have also seen what the power of broadband can do for rural America.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. You are a player in that space and a participant, so no doubt you have perspective. Now, what was the president's response?
The president said he was critically aware of the importance of broadband, that his administration is interested in making certain that rural America has both wired and wireless broadband available. He was preceded on the program by Secretary Tom Vilsack of the Department of Agriculture, and Vilsack also had talked about the importance of broadband to the rural economy, and that should be great for you, Craig, because tomorrow my understanding is that you have the Rust supervisor as your guest.
That's right. Jonathan Adelstein will be with us tomorrow, and he will be talking specifically about some of these programs and grants beyond the broadband stimulus that's going to be available for folks, and people need to really dial into that. You know, there's a lot of people wanting to move broadband forward, and I think some people assume that the broadband stimulus is, you know, it's over, which technically, yes, it is, because the money has been awarded, but there are still programs in place being pushed fairly aggressively by RUS, and there's some question also about, you know, we're after all this debt ceiling and budget discussion and so forth, you know, where are they in that picture? You know, are they still funded? Are they still funding and so forth? So, yes, they're going to – it'll be a good insight specifically into RUS. So from both of their comments, both the president's and Secretary Vilsack's, what do you think the biggest takeaway for you was in terms of the government's position on broadband and rural America?
The first takeaway was that I'm pretty convinced that federal money is going to be available to supplement projects in rural America. And I suspect, Craig, that will be true not just of RUS, but of other agencies in government as well. As a matter of fact, we are currently benefiting from a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services for a telemedicine initiative. So my first takeaway, money will be available. My second takeaway is public-private partnerships are going to be a spotlight of whatever the grant programs are that are going to be rolled out. And my third takeaway, that it seemed clear to me that the president is in tune with the importance of broadband and is not going to take it off his radar screen in the foreseeable future.
And that is definitely a good thing indeed. So to your first takeaway, tomorrow one of my questions to the administrator from RUS will address, you know, working with other grant programs within the federal government to, you know, mix and match and to come up with solutions. The public-private partnership thing obviously is key, and we should probably segue into, you know, that topic, because one of the reasons that you and I have had a number of discussions has to do with public-private partnerships and the value that they bring, because you have on the one side the public sector, the communities and stakeholders who want to move broadband forward, and they obviously understand the needs of their communities, and they have some sort of stake in that relationship that will make broadband a reality. Then on the flip side, you have the private sector companies that obviously their business is providing broadband services in one way, form, or fashion. And, you know, we really need to look at how they, working with the public sector, can advance both entities' you know, agenda, which is to do well and to you know, provide good broadband, and at the end of the day, we all win. I mean, and I assume that's, you know, that's pretty much the consistent position that you've come from as well.
Well, that's absolutely true. First of all, there is neither in the private sector the inclination to do everything that needs to be done or the money with which to do it. In other words, many of the providers today are not interested in enhancing networks because they're still trying to realize full potential from the networks they have. On the other hand, we have in many cases municipalities, in one case in Minnesota, a county, in still others, you know, several regions that are looking at what they believe is needed for their survival. And I use that term advisedly because I do believe that broadband technology has the potential to revitalize dying communities and regions and has the potential to make counties incredibly successful as well. But somehow the entities, the players, need to get together, matching up resources with people who generally and genuinely know how to operate networks to make certain that the result is a success both for the private sector partner and for the public sector partner.
Right, okay, and that makes sense. And to set up our top 10 list, because this is very intriguing to me how you have prioritized some of the tips and recommendations, it is important that you know, the people understand their partner. I mean, they have to understand what their needs are and then how they can adapt their own operation in order to be able to work together with each other. And so, you know, you have the experience of being in a number of public-private partnerships, and you also have networks that Hiawatha Broadband runs and owns in its entirety. And so I think your position is, you know, you've seen both sides of the house. So how did you come up with this? Actually, there's two sets of top 10 recommendations. One is from the public sector side, and the other is from the private sector side. But how did you come up with this?
Well, I was actually, Craig, asked to speak at the University of Minnesota, a telecom forum, and was asked about the opportunities and barriers and started thinking about our experiences and thought that, you know, one of the ways to approach this was to take a look at the sorts of things that we have at least discovered need to be in place if a project is going to be successful. And that's both from a provider standpoint or a private sector partner standpoint as well as the public partner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes plenty of sense. So let's just jump right in. I mean, I've gone through your list a couple times. We're going to start with the public sector perspective, but I like, you know, number 10, and your first comment is, you know, there is no substitute for vision. So let's, you know, take each of these points, and you can give us a little bit of, you know, feel for the, you know, what you're really trying to get across here. So what about the vision?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think, Craig, from a municipality or county standpoint, they really need to know why they want to do a project, and it's got to be a better reason than we want lower prices for our residents. And so for me, it all comes down to vision, because in the projects that we're involved in where there has been key solid vision, those projects have been enormously successful. At the expense of taking too much time, let me just make one comment or example about that. St. Charles, a community that's about 3,000 residents, about 20 miles west of Winona and 20 miles east of Rochester, came to us in 2001 saying that they wanted to develop a state-of-the-art network in their community because they wanted to become the number one bedroom community to Rochester, Minnesota, where the Mayo Clinic is located and where IBM has a large installation. They had concluded that in order for them to be successful in their goal, they needed to have state-of-the-art connectivity, because people would want to be able to work at home as successfully as they could work in their office. We had no interest up until that time in building a network in St. Charles. They actually offered to build the network for us, if you can imagine that, because they had concluded it was the only way to reach their goal. And so we collaborated on a strategy that brought a network to their community that opened in 2002. At the time that network was begun, there were two tiny housing developments being contemplated in St. Charles. Today, there are 8 very large developments occupied, and the local and regional and statewide media in Minnesota has referred to the community as Boomtown. So it's a clear example of knowing why you want to build a network and then pulling out all the stops to make it happen.
Okay, that makes sense. And that leads us to your number 9 tip, which is interesting because it may seem counterintuitive, which is, you know, you don't want to do this just to accomplish lower prices. Why explain that one a little bit?
Well, from my perspective, the issue is lower prices will follow. That's a given. But you'd better have a better reason for building a network than just to accomplish lower prices. I would submit that the biggest impact of HBC networks, whether public-private partnerships or simply private undertakings, are the economic development advantages that they bring for a community. So our first issue is always trying to convince them to think bigger than simply lower prices, because that will happen under any circumstance when competition arrives.
Makes perfect sense there. So now we look at point number 8, and there you talk about doing your homework, which I've admonished people to do on many occasions. So fill that one in a little bit for us on the homework part.
Well, the issue is that if you are planning to build a network as a competitor, the first supposition by the masses or the residents is that what's the price going to be, because they envision that whomever's coming in is going to offer the same thing as the incumbent. And that's why planning differentiators that can make a critical difference to residents of a community. They might be in the area of education, they might be in the area of healthcare, they might be in the area of security. Certainly, they're going to improve quality of life, but it's very important to know what's on the minds of residents of a community before that network plan is finalized and the construction begins. I think there is no substitute to a key market research or feasibility study, if you will, to determine what it is that's going to light up the faces of the people in the community.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about, I guess the assumption by the public side that they don't have any particular weakness, which is interesting because you make the point that they too are a monopoly, which, you know, would shake people's up a little bit, I think, in that thinking about that in that context. But what did you mean by that, that they're a monopoly?
Well, the issue is that any business has weaknesses. It's just a fact of life. While we'd rather not have them, there are things that we don't do as well as we ought to. And I just believe that it is necessary to constantly look at those things that you could do better. And I think that the service equation is clearly one of them. How many services are people subscribing to, and how many services might the network carry? I think that that's a critical reason, as I point out in my list, to look for a private sector partner, because in many cases, the people in a municipality, as an example, thinking of a network, don't have the capability to dream as large as they could with a little help from their friends.
Ah, right. So the private sector partner, in essence, expands the vision because they can come in with a different viewpoint of the world than the community itself might have envisioned alone.
Yeah, that's essentially it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, your next point, number six, you talk about recognizing the differences between the public and the private sector. So it's basically, if I'm reading this right, you're saying to the public sector side, and again, the public sector can be a consortium of local businesses and the library and the local government. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that the government alone is in that
No.
part of the partnership. But there's a difference between the two. So explore that one a little bit.
Well, there is a critical difference in the area of finance. Municipal finance, as an example, is far different than private sector finance. And municipalities, as an example, have little experience in running a business that has to operate as if it were a private sector enterprise. The cities that take on builds are essentially becoming, for the first time, a competitive entrant, if you will. Most of the enterprises they run, power, water, etc., are monopolistic in nature. And so having the experience of a private sector partner to help you understand the key indicators of how well a business is doing is, I think, a very critical component to any project.
Mm-hmm. And I think if I'm remembering correctly, in an interview for an article that I was doing, you mentioned that knowing what you know now, if you had it to do over again, and you were referring to the project involving Monticello, Minnesota, that your group would have learned more about municipal finance before starting, and Monticello's people would have learned more about business finance before you two started. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
You have a very good memory because that conversation took place a while ago. But that's exactly right. Neither of us knew the things about the financial side of the business from the other's perspective and what made the financial side tick for them.
Mm-hmm.
From the standpoint of municipal finance, that's like a world of darkness for us, just as I'm sure our world was a world of darkness for them. So now knowing what we know, as we contemplate new partnerships, we make certain that we are exploring the things we need to know while sharing with our partner the kinds of things that we believe are important from a financial point of view that will predict the success of an enterprise.
Mm-hmm. So fundamentally, bottom line, people need to understand finance both on their side of the house and on the private side of the house.
Our worlds are entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we would consider depreciation a critical component in any project from a financial point of view. From a public or a public side point of view, depreciation is nowhere to be found in their vernacular.
It's those kinds of things
that would have been helpful to us in Monticello, and it would have been helpful to Monticello, too, to understand the differences.
Okay. Maybe I'll just take a little bit of a break here. Why don't you take 2 minutes to explain is it Monticello or Monticello?
Monticello.
Okay. All right. To describe the nature of that relationship, what were you guys trying to achieve ultimately, and how is it working out today?
First of all, Monticello is a community about 40 miles north of the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So it is a northern suburb in many ways of the Twin Cities. It felt that it was slipping behind the economic development spectrum because it neither had a state-of-the-art network in place, nor were its providers interested in improving their networks. The community first, or the city first, went to them asking how they might partner. After they had exhausted those opportunities, they began to look around. They identified us as a company that might offer help to them. We went up, we talked to them. They asked us if we would consider partnering with them, and our first answer was no. Essentially because we didn't think we had the right kind of experiences to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And as their determination grew to get that network in place, and as our understanding improved of the absolute necessity of doing that, and one of our employees reminded us that part of our mission is to help rural America solve its connectivity issues, we decided to say yes. We now manage the FiberNet Monticello operation. We have a general manager there who is employed by HBC. All other employees are employed by the city of Monticello. And, you know, that's a very difficult thing. You need a very good partnership to make that possible. I'm pleased to say that we have worked with the city's help through all of the issues, and the operation is growing more quickly than the feasibility study estimated it would. It has been up and running for a year now, and its subscriber numbers are ahead of the curve. It's proving to be a very good thing for Monticello because, if you can believe this now, Craig, there are currently 2 fiber-to-the-home networks there and a third being contemplated.
So
TDS, who was the phone provider, built a fiber network shortly after it was announced that FiberNet would go ahead, or that the city would go ahead with its initiative.
Oh, right.
And
I remember that.
Now Charter Communications is also considering that.
Is there any chance that the entities might try to work together as opposed to competing? Because, I mean, I realize that Monticello is not a tiny place, but at the same time,
it's not a big place.
True. So having the competition is good. You don't want to get rid of that. But at the same time, you know, and maybe this is a question for a lot of small communities and rural communities, if you have all of a sudden an interest by 2 or 3 providers, does it make more sense to try to create complementary services, and will that still bring down prices and improve quality? Or, you know, do you just basically look at it as, you know, it's just, it's wide open competition and the consumer benefits and just let it run?
It's a good question, also a hard one to answer for me. I have seen little willingness on the part of private sector telecom providers to partner in cases like this. A pretty typical story is a public entity determining that for economic development reasons or others that they need to build a network and going to their current providers and saying, how can we work together to get this done? That seems an absolutely perfect solution to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think they come to HPC, because they know that's how we feel.
Right.
Most, for one reason or another, are not interested in those sorts of initiatives, unfortunately.
But at least, and as your point number five that says, you need to at least go seek that help and then go from there, which is a logical.
I mean, we would never encourage a public sector potential partner to make a decision to build a network before at least exploring extensively opportunities to partner with the incumbents.
Mm-hmm.
That just makes a whole lot of sense to me. Unfortunately, as I said, it rarely happens that the, I won't say never, but it rarely happens that the private sector incumbent is willing to partner. And, I think both sides lose in that prospect.
Right.
I think it's a matter of the private sector partner not quite being able to get its head around what are we giving up and what are we gaining.
Right.
And I think in all sincerity, the time has long since come when people ought to be sitting down and determining what the answer is. Because I think saying no is simply not an answer.
Right. It's
you can vote no, but it doesn't mean nothing will happen.
Right. So let's take moving along. Your recommendation number four is prepare a list of non-negotiables, which I find interesting. So what's that all about?
Well, it means that on each side of the fence, there has to be a list of things that both partners individually consider an absolute must for them. It's simply another way to make sure that no one is working in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if one of HBC's conditions is we want the absolute ability to run the network as we believe it needs to be run, we will provide the city with opportunities for input and feedback, but in the final analysis, if it concerns network operations, we need the right to say that isn't acceptable to us and move on. It's not a matter I hope it's not a matter of being pigheaded about things. I think it's a matter of sometimes public sector partners can get pretty carried away by isolated examples of sentiment that may just not work well for the total populace.
Okay, and I can see where that makes a lot of sense. All right. So know where your boundary lines are, basically, is what it comes down to. Your point number three addresses the issue of measuring success. Got to happen, no doubt about it. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I think the temptation, perhaps on each side, but I would see it at least in our cases as more critically on the side of the public sector partner, is to measure tons of things to collect data on tons of things until you're so awash in data, you can't see the operation. What we try to ask our public sector partners for is the ability to work together to create a list of a very few indicators by which the success of the project will be measured. So, for instance, in Monticello, it's the number of services in place. Services is actually, for us, a more important equation than the number of customers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we consider services. We consider, several financial indicators. Revenue is a key. You want to make sure that the business is growing, not just through expense control, but through revenue generation. So we measure the project against revenue and the revenue budget. We measure the project against cash flow. Cash flow for a new project is a more important indicator than profit, from my perspective. Profit is really a book thing, if you will. I'm no finance guy, don't pretend to be, but I do know that cash is king, and so we measure cash flow against budget. And I think also another key indicator, and one that absolutely has to be measured, is customer satisfaction.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So you can measure that in a number of ways that don't have to be, that don't have to represent expensive research projects.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that definitely makes a lot of sense. So now we move to point number two, or tip number two, almost at the top of our list here. So you talk about communication. Never stop communicating. Let's communicate about communication. How should we approach that?
Well, I think the key here is that you should never assume that your partner knows what you're thinking or knows what's going on. And you ought to take every opportunity, particularly in today's world when avenues of communication are so numerous, to make certain that you're keeping your partner abreast of progress, or conversely, the lack of it, if you will. I think that the one thing that I would always like to achieve with communication is that there are no surprises for either party ever. That's pretty idealistic, I understand, but, it shouldn't be a situation where at the end of the month your partner frankly finds out that it's been a pretty bad month and all of the indicators are going in the wrong place. I think if you're doing the job correctly, they're being informed on a regular basis, either by phone or email or in person. And so when the month comes out, you have provided them with enough information to understand why the indicators are where they are, but even more importantly, what you're doing to get them where they should be.
Mm-hmm. I find very clear logic in that. And so,
the issue, okay, Craig, as you and I both know, is every problem in the world is a communication problem.
Eventually, that will be the root. Somewhere,
yep.
Somewhere along
and
the line.
And so, you ought to learn how to do it well.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Let's talk about then the number one tip. Number one tip from the public sector perspective. You talk about, you don't do the deal till you have the right partner. Discuss.
Yep.
What are we talking about here?
The Evans anatomy determines for me whether and when deals are right.
Okay. Okay.
Whether it's hiring a new employee or whether it's taking on a new partnership, my head has to think the deal is right. And to be a little crass about it, my gut has to feel that the deal is right, too.
Mm-hmm.
Unless both of those anatomical features are in agreement, I try to force us back to the drawing board to make sure why I'm not feeling comfortable. And I will tell you that through way too many years, because I'm an old man, I have plenty of examples of telling you about mistakes I've made when one or the other of those components weren't in agreement with the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to, I think another way of looking at this is potential partners need to know each other well. I don't think that men and women should get married until they know each other well. And I don't think public and private sector partners should get married either until they know each other well and until they are convinced that they can work together and especially work together well in the hard times.
Right. And, you know, I can't say enough about the compatibility factor. So we have been going along here at a pretty, you know, in-depth pace here looking at these different topics. I want to shift now to the private sector, and we've got about 20 minutes, but I don't want to rush necessarily because we can always, you know, this is the internet. We can always bring you back for another discussion and fill out some of the details. And I think even if we come back on a second interview, we should talk about smart grid because we won't get to it today.
Yep.
But in another conversation with you, your ideas on smart grid were very, very interesting. I mean, I think our listeners.
It's a subject near and dear to my heart, but I don't think the second 10 are going to take as much time to go through because many of them are pretty similar to the public side.
Well, then let's run it on down. Let's start with number 10. It's all about the vision.
Okay. I think for the from the provider or private sector partner's point of view, you have to test that vision. You know, does it reflect the good thinking that you want it to, and does it match with the views of the residents in a community? Pretty simple stuff, but also pretty important.
Mm-hmm. And then we talk then next about examining the business plan. That's point number 9.
Yeah, I you know, we have looked at a number of business plans, both for individuals contemplating projects and also for communities or counties contemplating projects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very important that people understand the critical components of a successful business plan. And so we absolutely tell people up front that for us to be involved, we have to have the opportunity to look at the plan, and they have to be open-minded to at least hearing the
mm-hmm.
advice that we give them.
Right. And, you know, I can see where for the benefit of the relationship, that's going to make a lot of sense. So number 8, now this is interesting because you talk about testing the fortitude of the governing body to persevere.
Yep.
Give me a little bit more on that
one. Well, in any project today that involves a public sector partner, Craig, there are going to be significant, sometimes horrendous challenges. As an example, using Monticello, 74% of the people who voted on a referendum relative to a community telecom project in Monticello favored the project.
Mm-hmm.
So community sentiment was solidly in favor. And so the community proceeded, the city proceeded, and immediately one of the incumbents sued and delayed the project for a year. And the bonds for the project held in abeyance at the very last moment, there was like a week to go on the escrow account when the Court of Appeals finally upheld Monticello's right to build the network, and the Supreme Court, in a rare example of considering a plight and acting on it, ruled just 2 days later to uphold the appellate court's ruling. So if you're not up for significant challenges, don't consider getting in the business, would be my advice.
And that brings us actually to point number 7, where you say that there needs to be a public leader who's, you know, charismatic enough to go through those kinds of hard times of suits and uncertainty. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's been true for us in every partnership we've taken on. There has to be that figure who is known to and respected by large numbers of people in the community, a person that people turn to with trust, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been fortunate in every one of our partnerships to have that kind of strength that also helps to deal with point number 8, when the going gets tough, the person who's willing to get going to make sure that everybody understands how important this is and that even in spite of challenges, it is in fact the way to go.
So how would a private sector company, without stepping into an additional quagmire, are you suggesting that the private sector company identify who's that charismatic leader and support them, or to provide them information? Does the private sector company have some role in cultivating such a person? I mean, what's the acceptable role here?
Well, first of all, Craig, they're normally there.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably the persons who started the community thinking about the project to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the people with whom you work closely, or the private sector work closely, to put the necessary pieces into place. So it's a dual role, if you will. On the part of the private sector partner, it's making certain that that person or people have the information they need to respond to questions that they hear in their role. And in the case of the private sector partner, that person is someone whose opinion is respected, so when she or he says, oh gosh, please don't do that, because you understand that you're getting very solid, useful advice.
Mm-hmm. Good. That makes
sense. Know how to explain it better, but it's that out front person who believes in the project so much that she or he tastes it, feels it, believes it, lives it. And as you look at public-private partnerships or public initiatives, the ones that are successful all have a charismatic leader. As an example, let me quickly point to former Mayor Graham Richards in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Graham practically carried that project to fruition on his back, and I would say that the residents of Fort Wayne certainly owe him a sincere thank you for those efforts.
Right, and I know Graham pretty well, and he has definitely been on the case and has been a leader even after he was no longer mayor. He's still out there leading the charge and getting people to think through all the issues and so forth. Let's look at, so number 6 deals with, making sure that the community is doing this for the right reasons, which in some respects ties back to vision, if I'm not.
Yeah. It ties back to vision, and it ties back to the point about don't just do it for lower prices.
Exactly.
Do it for definite reasons that improve quality of life in the community and give residents a reason to rejoice around what they are and then have created. Mm-hmm. It's an absolutely critical key. And you know it when suddenly the community leaders are committed to the network and they're really turned on by what it can do for their residents in so many ways. You know, if my company was just interested in delivering voice, video, and data services, I wouldn't be as excited as I am by it delivering healthcare services, education services, and other quality of life services that really do make things better for the people it's serving.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, point number five, you're saying, you know, sit down and meet with the city finance director and find out how prepared they are to meet your needs. Is there a
yep.
quick test that you do to say, okay, this person's got it, their act together, and we're going to be great partners?
We sit down and show them our P&L that we need to generate every month. We take them through the components of it. We ask them if they can deliver it. And if they can't, we ask them if they're prepared to make the changes necessary to deliver it. And by the way, we do the same thing from their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
What is it they want from us? How do they want to receive it? And do we have the wherewithal to deliver it in the format in which they want it delivered?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you go on to talk about recommendation number four, you know, having your list of non-negotiables. And that, you know, I think we've already covered, and that's going to be,
yep.
you know, I think
same as point number four on the public partner side of the fence.
Right. And in similar fashion, number three addresses measuring your success and making sure that all the parties are involved with the that process of measuring how well you're doing and so forth. And so I think that makes sense. We can run on to that. Now, the next thing, number two, you know, you talk about communicate. Obviously, again, it's very important. What do you do in the case when communication isn't happening? And it was interesting because I got a call from a reporter yesterday from Kansas City who was talking about the fact that people, the general public, seems to be getting restive about the Google deal in Kansas City because there is so little information coming out. Now, I've met with a lot of the stakeholders in Kansas City when I was there, and I have had a couple of email exchanges with Google. So I know there's communication happening between the key players, but the general public is feeling that they're not part of the equation. Is this, from your perspective, now obviously we're on the outside looking in, but is this a potential problem for the
I think it is a potential problem. It certainly needs to be addressed. You know, there isn't anything in the case of Kansas City that the public wants to know that isn't known to someone.
Right.
But I think that, and this problem, by the way, affects all of us. You know, we're building six communities this summer, and I sat down with my team and I said, you know what? We have never done the job that I wish we'd do in communicating with constituents in the communities we're building. My recommendation is that we hire somebody to help us get it right. And we hired a firm with a very proven track record to help us make certain that we were providing timely, useful, and desired information to residents in the communities that we're building this summer via the means that they want to get it in. So we're using social media, we're using mass media, we're using telephone, we're using door-to-door visits. I mean, if you want people to buy your services ultimately, they have to feel involved and important to the project from the very beginning.
And that means the public at large, and
absolutely,
we have to take that in consideration. Because I think that, you know, you look at a company like Apple or Microsoft, you know, the true international giants. They're, you know, part of their PR mission is to control the message, and
yep.
I am starting to feel that when we get into these public-private partnerships, that corporate culture becomes a potential barrier to the maximizing of the partnership.
It does. As a matter of fact, Craig, it's very interesting to be talking about this in a discussion of public-private partnerships, because I think generally what you would find is the public sector partner more willing to and more prepared to and more experienced in communicating with constituents than the private sector firm, who for one reason or another, most of them not good in my mind, wanting to keep everything as quiet as possible.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the thing that has to be addressed early on, I believe, by both parties, particularly the public sector side. So
it absolutely does.
That leads us to the number one top recommendation for the private sector side is recognize the early signs of trouble. We talked about in communication, you know, what those signs might be. But are there signs of other types of trouble that the private sector partner needs to be aware of?
Well, I mentioned a couple on my list. You're in trouble when everyone wants to steer the ship, if you will. You know, there's still only room for one pilot on a ship at a time. And if the focus is constantly diverted because someone heard this from one person and someone heard something from another and whatever, and all of a sudden you get paralyzed by all of the things you're being told to do, that's a very bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are the signs. If you have a set of indicators, you need to look at them closely and steer the enterprise by them. They will provide you with plenty of information for course corrections if you're paying attention. If you discover that communication is going on all around you but not with you, I would suggest you'd better figure out a way to get in the middle of the discussion.
Right.
So, you know, it really does go back to those things that are just common sense. What's the communication saying? What are you hearing? All of those things tend to be very early indicators of things you ought to be paying attention to.
Mm-hmm. So we have about a minute left. What's the one thing, if you could leave people with one thing, how do you make the public private partnership maximize its potential benefit?
It is simply a matter, Craig, in my experience, of sitting down together and hammering out an understanding that leaves both of you with a very clear roadmap of what needs to be done, what will be done, and when it will be done.
Can't think of much to top that. Gary, I want to thank you very much for your time today and your insights. I definitely look forward to having, you know, additional conversations as we watch broadband unfold. And I also want to thank you for being both a supporter and a sponsor for the show, because you understood what we were doing early on from day one, and so that's been very helpful and gratifying.
Craig, I've been delighted to be a guest. Rural broadband is my passion. Public-private partnerships are a way to make progress in rural America, and I've had a great time.
Good
so
deal.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I also want to thank our media sponsors, Broadband Communities Magazine, GigaOM, and MuniWireless.com, and also Jay Ovatore, who's my online co-host who's keeping things lively in the chat room. So thank you, everyone, for being here today and joining tomorrow. We'll have our U.S. Administrator, Jonathan Adelstein, on the show talking about more money and how to get to it.